discharge our duties effectively. Since 1973, the division has filed 400 lawsuits under the Consumer Protection Act. Approximately 25% of these cases have involved conduct which fit only within the parameters of Section 1746A. Finally, for this defendant, in this case, to complain that the phrase false, misleading, or deceptive is vague seems particularly inappropriate, for the reason that this defendant himself has relied on a phrase in the federal banking laws which prohibits giving false information, and I quote, to a federally chartered bank. It would seem that applying the laws of the facts in this case, the defendant is fully aware of the meaning of the term false, and that is the conduct involved herein. Thank you.
Further argument from the phone?
Please, the court. My name is Robert Wallace, and I represent James Lewis. At Mr. Bragg's request, I allotted 5 minutes of time to the Attorney General because I felt there was a public interest involved in this case. But as the court is aware, I represent Mr. Lewis's private interest. I want to make sure that his interest gets adequately represented in this case. Before I discuss that, there are two issues on facts which I would like to discuss. One, the most important fact in this case is the fact that after all of this negotiation or information gathering, the bank, in full knowledge of everything that Mr. Lewis had said, in full knowledge of what the Allied Bank had said, had Mr. Lewis sign a note. Now, that is a legal act with legal consequences. He signed the note. They kept the note, did not write void on it, never gave it back to him until he finally got it back in trial several years later. He signed the note, which is what he was supposed to do. They didn't give the money, which is what they were supposed to do, and that's what this lawsuit was all about. The second fact that there is dispute about is the discussion that there is no laundry list violation. Now, it is correct that the Court of Civil Appeals said that they, in their view, there was no evidence to support a laundry list violation. However, the jury found a deceptive trade practice, and they were instructed that a deceptive trade practice included causing confusion or misunderstanding as to the source, sponsorship, approval, or certification of goods and services, or representing that goods or services have sponsorship, approval, characteristics, ingredients, uses, benefits, or quantities which they do not have, which the direct lies, outright lies, that the bank told both Mr. Lewis, the Riverside Bank told both Mr. Lewis and the Allied Bank, both were violations of that language. They represented that the loan had been made, that the draft was in the mail, that Mr. Lewis should sign this note, and the deal was complete, and none of that was true. So we submit that there is more than adequate evidence of laundry list violations and that the discussion of 1746A shouldn't be reached in this case. Now to Mr. Lewis. Mr. Lewis is entitled to his whole judgment. And in this case, that means he's entitled to have his actual damages, to have them trebled, not to penalize the defendant, but because the defendant forced Mr. Lewis to trial in this case after notice of their violation of the deceptive trade practice, and to his exemplary damages and attorney's fees, the attorney's fees under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and his exemplary damages because the defendant did it on purpose and with malice as found by the jury. The Act in 1973, we would argue, is clear that a double recovery is permitted. The Act, as this Court knows, in 1979 was amended and now provides for no double recovery and no recovery of trebling unless the defendant knew about his conduct, unless he had some bad faith or bad motive. But in 1973, the Act provided that it was cumulative of all other remedies, and one of the other remedies was common law fraud. The second thing that Mr. Lewis needs to have clarified is that if an election is required between his common law remedies and his deceptive trade practice remedies, he doesn't care which he recovers on, because monetarily it amounts to about the same to Mr. Lewis. It allows him a few more dollars if he recovers under the deceptive trade practice. So if both remedies are valid and an election is required, he elects the deceptive trade practice remedy. If the court is of the opinion, and I'm going to devote the rest of my argument to suggesting that that opinion would not be correct, but if the court feels that the deceptive trade practice remedy is inappropriate, then the appropriate thing for the court to do is to affirm the judgment of the trial court in this case, which would have the effect of awarding Mr. Lewis his actual damages and his exemplary damages. And the court should further modify the trial court's judgment by adding the award of attorney's fees, since the exemplary damage instruction given to the jury in this case did not include that attorney's fees were an item of exemplary damages, which is proper under cases cited in our brief. The rest of our argument will be devoted to the question whether or not the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is applicable to extensions of credit, since we understand that to be the issue that the court is interested in hearing about. The first point, and I think the most important point, is that the Texas legislature, long before the Deceptive Trade Practices Act that we're concerned with, that being the Act of 1973, was made, specifically intended for deceptive trade practices of lending institutions to be regulated by the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. I would, we have made this argument at great length, and with all the citations in our post-submission brief under counterpoint one, but it's important enough that I'd like to briefly summarize it. The predecessor of the 1973 Act, The Deceptive Trade Practices Act of 1973 didn't spring full-blown from the head of the legislature with no prior law. They didn't just go grab the Federal Trade Commission Act and decide that it was such a good idea to have it in Texas that we just adopted. Texas had a Deceptive Trade Practices Act before 1973, and it was found in Article 5069, 10.01 through 10.08. And it had a legislative history. And in item one says, many citizens of our state are being victimized and abused in various types of credit and cash transactions. After finding a hardship in item four, the legislature says, such abuses are especially prevalent in the area of consumer transactions, both cash and credit. Unscrupulous operators, lenders, and vendors, many of whom are transient to our state, are presently engaged in many abusive and deceptive practices in the conduct of their businesses. These unregulated practices bring great social and economic hardship. Then they go on, and I've listed it for about two pages in our post-submission brief, to repeat again and again that the Deceptive Trade Practice Act is specifically designed to cover lenders, of whom Riverside Bank is one. Now, the 1973 Deceptive Trade Practice Act expanded the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to cover more people, to cover merchants. But this court should not take the position that the legislature, in intending to increase the purview of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, intending to increase the protection offered to consumers, somehow managed to miss the very people that the first Deceptive Trade Practices Act of Texas was designed to get. Second, I think that the construction of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which would include extensions of credit, falls within the basic theory of Deceptive Trade Practices Act as we were all taught going to law school and becoming lawyers, and that is that such an act is designed to prevent unconscionable dealings between persons with small economic power when dealing with persons of great economic power.
It wouldn't make any difference if Mr. Hunt had been involved here, would it? Wouldn't he still have the cause of action that you're talking about?
That's correct, Your Honor. As a matter of law, he would, although he probably wouldn't be a person that the legislature was designed to protect, but they would have to protect Mr. Hunt as well as Mr. Lewis to grant equal protection of the law. My point that I'm trying to make is that if the court separates out this kind of transaction, simply because it's a credit transaction, that the court is going to wipe out a broad area of coverage that was intended and should have been intended by the state in passing this act. It's one thing to say that the banks are heavily regulated, and it's true, but they're not heavily regulated in this area. No one has come to this court and cited a federal statute that Mr. Lewis could have gone into federal court and prosecuted Riverside Bank for this action.
Counsel, is there a difference in your opinion in the term credit transaction where you buy merchandise from a merchant on credit as distinguished from borrowing money from a bank?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that was a point I was going to make, that in this case, I don't think, well, I can't see a difference. Let's make it, take it one step farther. Let's get to a car. People go every day and buy cars at the General Motors place and get their financing from the General Motors Acceptance Corporation. Now, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation is not a bank, but it acts the same as a bank. It's a big institution. It's got a lot of money. You have to fill out all the same forms to get money from GMAC as you do from a bank. I could see a distinction. If somebody could point to me and say, well, you have a federal statute that regulates this unscrupulous practice, and you had a federal remedy that you could have pursued, and therefore your federal remedy supersedes your state remedy. But there isn't any federal remedy for this sort of action. You can't go to the comptroller of the currency and get this matter straightened out. So the state of Texas has a valid and ongoing public interest in regulating all of these people, GMAC, Ford Motor Company Credit Corporation, Riverside National Bank, all the state banks, the loan sharks, everybody that extends credit should be regulated in this fashion. That is, they should not be allowed to put people in this position. And I feel very strongly about that because I've listened to the Court of Civil Appeals indicate that they didn't think that the finding of malice that the jury considered at length and came back with was appropriate. The finding of malice was based, in my estimation, on instruction to the jury, which was not objected to, that malice was founded on reckless disregard for the rights of others. I can't imagine anything more reckless than taking a loan application. Here's a man, and we're told that one of the problems in the case was that he didn't tell him one payment was overdue. Well, he told him, for heaven's sakes, that he'd gotten a loan already from Allied Bank, and here he is in Riverside Bank wanting to move the loan. It doesn't take a great application of wit to figure out there's a problem with the loan at Allied Bank. That's why it needs to be moved. And we're not saying, and never have said, that if they had just refused the loan, from the word go, so we don't want your business, there wouldn't have been any lawsuit. There wouldn't have been any deceptive trade practice. But that's not what they did. They said, we're going to take the loan. We're going to save your car. Come on in. And after everything else was done, they get him to come in and sign the note, putting him on the line for another $13,000. And then, after it's all over with, they say, well, we're just not going to do it. That's the sort of thing that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act was meant to cover. That's the sort of high-handed dealing that people with strong economic power wield on people that have no economic power.
You were just buying a Mark IV Continental
Cadillac, Your Honor.
Pullman that you're talking about.
There's evidence on that, Your Honor, that Mr. Lewis had a compensation settlement. Well, it was an expensive car, and one that he was probably foolish to buy, but one that he'd still have, in all likelihood, or would have had at least for 14 more months, if the bank had simply done what they said they were going to do. He could have paid out the payments out of his $6,000 CD for 2 years. But he didn't get to do that. Now, there's some legal points about the questions of extension of credit that I think bear looking into. One is, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act of 1973 says that it covers false, misleading, or deceptive acts in trade or commerce. I think the word commerce is an operative word in the court's consideration, because I think classically extensions of credit and credit transactions are commerce and always have been. Second, I think that no one has suggested, and this goes to the question of the FTC Act, no one has brought forward a case from the FTC Act, whether it related to banks or any credit institution, that suggested that the acts that Riverside National Bank was found guilty of were okay under the Federal Trade Commission Act. Nobody said that these things were approved. Nobody said that it's okay to do that. Therefore, all of this discussion about whether the Federal Trade Commission Act thinks it's okay or doesn't think it's okay is not really the issue in this case. The Federal Trade Commission hasn't got a case on this subject, and I'd be surprised if a case ever came down saying, oh yes, it's all right to bring somebody in, have him sign a note and keep it 2 or 3 years and not go through with your end of the deal.
Counsel, would you help me understand your position and origin that this is a consumer, that Lewis is a consumer under the Act?
Yes, sir. I think that it depends on which side of the coin you start with. Our position is that Lewis is classically a consumer of the service that the bank provided, the service being extending credit under the various terms. So I think the issue is whether or not extension of credit is a service. And I think that once the question, if you affirmatively answer that extensions of credit are a service within the definition of trade and commerce and within the definition of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, that it's clear that he was a consumer of that service. That's what he went to the bank for, to get an extension of credit.
Now, are you tying that into statutory definition?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the statutory definition you're tying this into?
That the consumer is defined as someone who seeks the goods or services of the person who is defined as a merchant or a business entity under the Act. So it's a circular sort of a deal, which is like when they define service as service, you get into these, but I think it's a legitimate question, and I don't mean to belittle the Act.
Well, it's a question that's troubling some of
us. It's a question which troubles me, and the question is, where do you get into analyzing it? And I think that it boils down, in our view, to whether or not an extension of credit is a service. Because if it is, then it seems clear to me that that's what Mr. Lewis went to the bank to get, and that's what he's consuming, that service. That's the deal he made. Now, there are a couple of cases that no one has talked about. There are two cases where the courts of civil appeals have been faced with banks under a Deceptive Trade Practice Act allegation. I'd like them a lot better if the plaintiff had prevailed in one of them, but they didn't, and I think that there's a reason for that, and I want to discuss it. The cases are the Cantrell versus the First National Bank of Euless and Austin. See if I got them. Thompson versus the First Austin Company. Both of those cases are cases where the bank fulfilled its obligations under the contract that it made with the consumer. And then the consumer alleged a Deceptive Trade Practice Act because they said there was another deal. In the First Austin Company case, the plaintiff suggested that there was an oral agreement for an extension of time to make a payment. The bank denied it. The jury found there was such an oral agreement. The court ultimately said, the court of civil appeal, that it didn't make any difference whether there was or there wasn't because there was no consideration for it. And if there's no consideration for it, then it can't happen as a matter of law. I think the distinction in these cases is neither court suggested that the Deceptive Trade Practice Act did not apply to the extension of credit, but rather said that the item which the consumer intended to consume, he got. So that our view is that the question in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is whether or not the consumer is misled about the deal that he made in the first place. And in this case, we say he was. He signed the note in good faith and didn't get the money. Finally, I would like to address the question of, under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, this question of constitutionality and notice. It's certainly true that in order to give someone due process and take their property, that you have to give them notice. But the thing that's been forgotten in this case is that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act provided for notice, and that the evidence in this case is uncontroverted that notice was given to the bank before suit was filed, and that they didn't respond to that notice, and that's what the Deceptive Trade Practices Act penalizes, not the original act, but the failure to respond to it once the notice is given, which then causes the consumer to have to go into court and litigate this matter. I have nothing further to say on the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. I would like to make one point clear on the question asked by the Chief Justice of Mr. Wilson. There is no question in the plaintiff's mind that he is entitled to recover his actual damages under any theory at this point, that there is no theory available to the court under the points of error presented by the respondent that would deprive Mr. Lewis of his actual damages. Further, the plaintiff has attacked on cross-application the finding of the Court of Civil Appeals that overruled the jury verdict on the issue of malice, so that the court is obligated to consider on cross-point whether or not the Civil Appeals Court was correct in disregarding the jury finding of malice, and would need to rule on that question in order to determine whether or not, in addition to the actual damages, Mr. Lewis was entitled to his exemplary damages, which we would urge the court to, for the reasons set out in our cross-appeal, is the correct course of action, and that in the event the court feels that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is not appropriate, they should affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The rebuttal argument from petitioner.
And please, the court. Briefly, with regard to the question that Chief Justice Greenhill raised at the end of my argument, reading at page 561, this is what the court said. It said that in our case, the jury found, for instance, issue one, that Riverside Bank or Carroll, after agreeing to refinance Lewis's car, knew or should have known that such refusal would result in repossession of it, loss of the CD, and damage to the credit rating. The jury also found under Issue 8 that such action violated the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. We hold that these two findings, plus the finding of fraud, finding to Issue 7 that such actions constitute fraud on Lewis, were supported by the evidence in this case, and that they support a judgment under Section 1746, that is, the findings of foreseeability of loss, deceptive trade practices, and the finding of fraud together, the way I read this, support a finding of a violation of Section 1746, which of course is the part of the Act which defines deceptive trade practices. The court then goes on to hold that a deceptive trade practice was committed, that the trebling of damages was mandatory, and that the exacting of attorney's fees was mandatory. We feel, and we have treated this as being a case all along in which the Court of Civil Appeals treated the finding of fraud as supportive of and in substantiation of its conclusion that deceptive trade practices were committed, and while we did not, in the statement of appointed error, say the Court of Civil Appeals erred in holding fraud, we have attacked that holding of the Court of Civil Appeals throughout. I would like to address a point made by counsel that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is not new as of 1973. Certainly that's true. I think the first act was passed in 1967. I think it was then amended again in 1969, and then was passed as the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in 1973. Now, what this legislative history consisted of was an act, a comprehensive legislative enactment by the Texas legislature called the Consumer Credit Code, which regulated the operation or the business of consumer credit. As a stepchild to the Consumer Credit Code, the legislature included a chapter or a subchapter or a section on deceptive trade practices, which defined some of the same laundry list violations and provided some administrative remedies, no private causes of action or anything like that. In 79, the Consumer Credit Code was again amended. It's been amended and revised several times since, but I mean in 69. In 69, when it was amended, I'm not sure whether any of the consumer protection part of the deceptive trade practice part was dealt with, but certainly a legislative history dealing with an act which encompassed both of these concepts would have spoke to both deceptive trade practices and consumer credit violations.
Counsel, let me ask you this. When the Deceptive Trade Practice Act portion was moved from the Consumer Credit Code, as was enacted in 67, over to the Business and Commerce Code in 1973, is there any language in the reenactment or the changing of that that would indicate that the admitted purpose of the original act to cover credit transactions was no longer the law?
I cannot say right now. I can give the court the benefit of citation on the act, which I looked at and wish I had looked at that question because it was interesting. In the session laws, it was passed by the 63rd legislature. It's chapter 143. It was House Bill 417. Interestingly, it amended both. It created a Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which was placed in the Business and Commerce Code, and it amended the Insurance Code, providing for the application of deceptive trade practice provisions of this act to specific activities under the Insurance Code, and in that sense, it changed the earlier law, which would have kept the Deceptive Trade Practices Act as it was a part of the Consumer Credit Code from applying to the operations of the insurance industry. Now, in this line, I submit to the court that this divorcing of deceptive trade practices from the Consumer Credit Code was done with a purpose, and that purpose was this: credit transactions and the kind of consumer transactions that the Consumer Protection Act is aimed at are different kinds of activities. Basically, our Consumer Credit Code goes to the control and the regulation of usury and things of that sort, whereas the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is aimed at protecting that consumer who is buying something, goods or services, from a merchant, not somebody who is dealing with a bank. And the question comes up, you buy a car, a Ford, and you borrow money from Ford Motor Credit. Well, you buy the car possibly from Luke Johnson Ford in Houston, and as between you and Luke Johnson, you are a consumer, and the Deceptive Trade Practices Act regulates that transaction. Luke Johnson's office writes up the paper by which the Ford Motor Credit Corporation then extends you a loan. That activity is under the Consumer Credit Code and is regulated by the Consumer Credit Code. Now, how can you be injured by buying a car, by having the condition of the car misrepresented to you, for one example? And if that happens, you may have an action under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. But how are you going to be injured by borrowing money? Well, maybe they withhold the money they promised to lend. Or maybe they charge you excessive interest. Or maybe they resort to some kind of abusive collection tactics. Those things are not governed by the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. They're governed by the Consumer Credit Code and the numerous other provisions of law dealing with the creditor lender, the lender-borrower relationship. They are two separate areas, and that, I think, is why the Deceptive Trade Practices stepchild was taken out of the Consumer Protection Act, I mean out of the Consumer Credit Code, and elevated to an equal status in another part of the law, put in its own house to serve its own function in its own way without being something that the Commissioner of Consumer Credit might incidentally occasionally take an interest in and ask the Attorney General to do something about. They are two separate areas of activity. They are regulated differently, and they are not dealt with. The legislative history of the old Consumer Credit Code, which had a chapter on deceptive trade practices, really has nothing to do with the interpretation of this act as the legislature first passed it in 1973 and has been molding and developing it ever since with the aid of the courts and writing the numerous opinions interpreting it.
Counsel, would you comment on, as I understood counsel for the opponent, saying that notwithstanding all of these things, I still have a common law right to my judgment?
Well, if he has a common law right to his judgment, that is dependent on whether or not he has made a cause of action under the common law. Now, what we have here is a man who came in and he made some false entries in that application. It's been argued that Mr. Carroll knew about it. It's been argued that Mr. Carroll assisted him in making those false entries. And it has been stipulated that Mr. Carroll acted for the bank and that the bank was responsible for Carroll's acts. But it's not been stipulated that Mr. Means or any individual officer of the bank was bound by some unlawful act that Mr. Carroll and Mr. Lewis entered into. Now, if he has a common law cause of action, and I don't question that there is a common law cause of action, which is a remedy, aside from any Deceptive Trade Practices Act, a wrongful violation of a commitment to lend money affords a remedy. It is a breach of contract. But there is also a rule applicable in the common law that when the contract encompasses, involves, or requires a violation of law, particularly of penal law, in this case, a statute which makes it a felony to enter these false entries in the loan application with the intent of influencing the bank and for the purpose of influencing the bank and knowing that they're false, if that happens, the contract becomes unenforceable. So, yes, he has a common law remedy if he can get over the fact that he committed a crime to make this contract, with or without Mr. Lewis's aid. Again, emphasize one more time, I don't question that banks render a service. But is it the kind of service that is defined in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act? Is it a service that you agree to purchase or lease? Is it work or labor? No, I don't think it is. And because the bank did not agree to sell, and Lewis did not agree to purchase or lease goods or services as defined in the Act, we don't have a consumer here in the first place.
One more time, you say you may have a common law remedy, which I take includes fraud?
It could include fraud, yes, Your Honor.
And we have a jury finding that such acts constituted fraud.
Yes.
Court of Civil Appeals found fraud. You got no point on fraud. This is
well,
a problem.
The court of, okay, the The Court of Civil Appeals, in treating the fraud, though, treated it as a supportive element of the deceptive trade practices. They didn't treat it as a separate cause of action for which recovery could be allowed. They denied his recovery. This is what is difficult with the Court of Civil Appeals' opinion. They said, going to the question of malice, it has not been shown, however, that anyone at Riverside Bank consciously misled Lewis, had anything to gain by misleading him, had any desire to harm him, or had any evil intent or bad faith. But what appears to have been a lack of communication between Carroll and Means resulted in plaintiffs being unable to avoid a monetary loss. They then turn around and say that a finding of fraud coupled with a finding of damage and foreseeability of injury and a finding that a deceptive trade practices occurred resulted in a violation of Section 17.46 of the Business and Commerce Code, which is that part of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act which makes false, misleading, and deceptive acts or practices, or deceptive trade practices, unlawful. So the Court of Civil Appeals, I don't believe, found fraud as a separate basis of recovery, but rather said that the court, that the jury found deceptive trade practices, and since they found fraud, we think it's sustainable. I think that's the way they treated it. And it may be that that the whole thing needs to be sent back for further inquiry in that area, but the way the Court of Civil Appeals treated it, I don't think it was treated as a basis for a separate grounds of recovery. And even if it was, you still have the question of illegality. He's basically suing on a breach of contract here, and he...
Let me ask you about that.
Okay.
I go to a bank, or X goes to a bank to borrow money. The banker thinks that he's trustworthy and good for it, but he tells him, well, the bank examiner's coming around and I need to have a financial statement from you in the file. It really doesn't make any difference. I'm going to lend you the money anyway. Just put something on that. And some of the information he puts on his financial report is wrong. Now, is that, in your mind, an illegal transaction?
Well, now, has he loaned him the money already?
Yes. Well, yes.
Or he's going to loan him the money?
Well, assuming that he's going to loan him the money.
Okay.
But he tells him, I'm going to lend you the money anyway. But before I lend you the money, I want you to just fill me out a little form here for the bank examiner.
In that case, he probably has not followed this act simply because he's already made up his mind to lend him money and it's not going to influence the...
But as far as the statute is concerned...
As far as the statute is concerned, it is a criminal act because the representation could have influence the bank. That is the holding of the Braverman case and several of the federal cases interpreting that statute. I think it happens every day, but it is also the type of thing which, if abused, is what the federal law is intended to prevent. And why is the federal law intended to prevent that? Because where do the banks get the money they lend? They get them from the depositors, you and me. Demand deposits at no interest and time deposits at interest. They take the money in from their depositors. They loan it out at interest. And if the banks are permitted to make bad loans, banks fail. And how do we protect against that? The FDIC, federal insurance. And how do we protect the FDIC and ultimately us, the taxpayers, by preventing the very thing that happened here, by making it a crime?
One last question.
Yes.
Can you think of any other group that would be included within the definition of trade and commerce that the legislature intended, according to your contention, to exempt from the applicability of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act because maybe they were regulated by some other agency or in some other way?
Maybe I can shed some light by going at it another way. The legislature felt it was necessary to specifically include the insurance industry.
What about truckers? They're pretty heavily regulated. You think they could commit a Deceptive Trade Practice Act?
I would have to look at the section of the Federal Trade Commission Act because it exempts areas other than banking.
What about attorneys?
They're regulated.
Okay, let me answer this one. If you sell a service, and truckers sell a service, if you sell a service and lawyers sell a service, then you are subject to the act unless exempt. Now, if you look at the Federal Trade Commission Act, you have a laundry list of exemptions, the first of which is banks. I believe the truckers may be, or some of the haulers may be, because they're heavily regulated. I don't think lawyers are.
Texas Act doesn't exempt anybody by specific language, does it?
I think the exemption is picked up in the, yes, it does, matter of fact. Let me find that. Okay, nothing in this subchapter shall apply to the owners or employees of a regularly published newspaper, magazine, telephone directory, broadcast station, or billboard where the advertisement is in violation of this subchapter, is published or disseminated unless it is established that the owner or employee of the advertising medium has knowledge of the false, deceptive, and misleading act or practice declared to be unlawful by this subchapter or has a direct or substantial financial interest in the sale, distribution, or unlawful advertised goods or services. So it picks up certain specific exclusions, and then it incorporates that. Now this is reading 1749 of the 73 Act. It also incorporates the regulations of the Federal Trade Commission in this section, saying that areas regulated by the Federal Trade Commission are regulated by this act, and areas that are specifically exempt by the Federal Trade Commission are exempt under this act, and then other areas are catch-as-catch-can. It doesn't say that, you know, this is definitive.
That's all.
Thank you, counsel. The case is again submitted on oral argument and written briefs of both parties. That concludes the oral submission for the morning, and the marshal is adjourned to court.
Oh yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.